Good morning. You know that taxes and that other thing may be inevitable, but what's up for discussion again this year is whether to reinstate Hawaii's higher individual tax rates. Hawaii Tax Foundation's Tom Yamachika looks at that and other bills that could mean you'll pay more. And are political scientists any better at curbing implicit bias than the rest of us? Our political scientist Neil Milner weighs in. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's a theatrical event, a Hawaiian language performance that incorporates hula, mele, and ole to tell a centuries-old story. We'll meet its author, Tammy Haileopua Baker, and comedic hypnotist Ron Soderstrom wants to make an improv artist out of you, even if he has to hypnotize you to do it.
It's Wednesday, February 17th. The conversation starts after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Social scientists really want us to present their information in such a way as, like, I am the one who is without bias, right? It sort of depends on that.
And that they've done their studies well and they've been safeguarding against a lot of that. But as we're going to find out in our conversation this morning, maybe not so much. Now, you might think that political and social scientists might be less affected by implicit bias. But a group of women and other researchers say that just because they study bias, it doesn't mean that they have any better chance of not having to deal with it. Our contributing editor and social scientist, Neil Milner, joins us now to explain. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We're talking about the link between implicit bias and discrimination. And we've talked with, for example, Justin Levinson from the UH Law School about what a lot of people might point to, racial bias, how that might turn up in a legal situation. But looking at what we're going to talk about this morning, it's almost a bit of a wonderment that social scientists who know they're going off to study this yet find themselves in the same position of having to be affected by it.
Well, my students may not have thought this, but we're human too, actually. And the fact is, it's implicit bias. By implicit, it means that it's an unconscious kind of bias that's often contrary to people's explicit values, to our own explicit values. And we found this in all kinds of things. And it really has to do, to a great extent, with how the brain works. I mean, the brain has to somehow filter out millions and millions of stimuli at any given point. And one of the ways that we do that is to have these sorts of filters that work. And some of these filters might be good filters, they might be bad filters, but they're generally unconscious filters. They operate. And so we find that there is implicit bias in all kinds of things. In this case, it involves a group of women who did this blog post, a group of women political scientists who are part of an organization called Women Who Know Stuff, and I'll get back to that later. And they posted a bias showing that political scientists have the same kinds of implicit bias that show up in all kinds of other things, certainly in sciences, that women are cited less, that women are called less as experts, all of these kinds of things. And the blog post says, you guys who do this post, this is the Monkey Cage, a very good
Washington Post
Monkey Cage, you guys explicitly support what we're doing, but you still see this kind of implicit bias there.
All of that said, it sort of syncs with what we've seen over time with a great gender gap between, pay equity of what women make, what men make, general understandings of how we might look at someone who has got a little bit more weight on their body than some other people do, maybe people who wear glasses. I mean, we tend to know these things, and yet you say that implicit bias is still working, but especially in something that is as, forgive me for saying this, it's polar opposites, men and women, we don't seem to be able to get through that yet.
Well, it's because it's very hard to change. You know, the problem, we have to be very careful here. All of the discrimination is not because of implicit bias. There's structural things. The glass ceiling operates for other kinds of reasons. But the fact of the matter is that it's hard to change some of these things because it's the way we've learned to think and the way that we think without thinking. So when you look at this kind of research, and there's a lot of it in regard to women in the sciences, and even in women in the more mathematically oriented fields of political science, political methodology, what you see is all the way up from a set of assumptions all the way up to the result of that assumptions, you see a kind of implicit bias. When you give a group of scientists, academic scientists, dossiers to hire a student lab assistant, so it was a fairly, you have to know a fair amount about sciences, and the dossier is the same. Of course, the people don't know that this is a false dossier. The dossiers are exactly the same all the way down the line, except in one case they're males, in the other case they're females. Both male and female scientists tend to be more interested in hiring the male, more interested in giving that person more money, and more interested in mentoring that kind of person. And you find that, so you have a kind of bias from the ground up, which makes it very difficult to deal with, even if you get past the resistance, which says, I'm not like that. So you have all kinds of good policies in regard to hiring, in regard to diversity, and those things are important, but you still have this other kind of persistent, pervasive set of biases operating.
Okay, so this XY bias that you just talked about, which in some ways also flowed out of an article in The Atlantic from yesterday, keeps pointing to some of these same factors, and yet we don't see the conversation changing all that much. Those tiny increments of change, though, maybe it just is to say that it's going to take a lot longer, because you mentioned the point that it's how you're taught to think. It's what, you know, you grow up knowing or think you know. And, of course, the resistance to say, I'm prejudiced, because none of us wants to feel that we are, but implicit bias affects all of us. So is that enough to say that if you really change how someone is taught, then, in fact, you're going to be able to pull against this at some point?
Well, it's pretty hard. The experiments that they've done in regard to changing people's behavior are just that, they're experiments. So let's talk about a few different ways that they've tried to deal with this. And remember, it's not that you've been taught explicitly to think this way. You've developed standards, you've developed filters, kind of absorbing into the culture. One of the straightforward things you try to do is to make more information available. Women Who Know Stuff, for example, is a blog that lists political, a website that lists a whole bunch of women political scientists and their expertise. You click on it, you get a long list, so you can draw from that. Another is to have certain kind of policies. But when you try to actually change this behavior, what they've done is try to do things experimentally. For example, it appears that if you just tell someone it's unjust, and you try to teach a group of people, don't do it because it's unjust, you should change behavior, that doesn't work. Which seems to work better is to have disorienting stereotypes. So they introduce a picture of a woman in a hard hat, dressed like a construction worker, breastfeeding her baby. And that seems to have an effect of changing things when you make the story more nuanced. So there's that kind of thing going on there. The problem, or at least the challenge, is that we don't know how much of that is a long-term effect here. So that those are the kinds of things that we try to do. Awareness, policies that encourage another kind of thing, but also trying to find a way to work with these kind of complicated, subtle, and again, implicit things that operate in our minds.
So, for example, with the construction worker breastfeeding the baby, someone looking at that and saying, oh, look at that. You know, somebody could be involved in, I mean, but even they might not even know that they're thinking this,
right,
that, oh, look, there's a person who is involved with construction that's also a mom. But you're also suggesting that that might just be sort of a novel thought, but not necessarily something that would change perception about who construction workers are and whether or not they regard their families in the same way.
It appears to change it, but we only know that it changes it for a short period of time, that over time we don't know.
And that's a novel factor.
That's a novel factor. And again, it's competing with all kinds of other things in the culture. So again, it's a very hard thing to change. Making people aware certainly helps, and helping people understand that they're not any more rational than anybody else, that this is the way our brain works, also helps understand. But there's this additional kind of changing stimulus.
Very, very, very quickly. So what's the big takeaway from knowing all of this?
The big takeaway is that it's a big and subtle problem, and that we have to deal with it in some different sorts of ways in terms of teaching people to behave in other ways, because teaching means something that's not didactic, not saying this is how you should behave. That doesn't seem to work.
No, it has to do with your own behavior and the people who watch it.
And it has to do with disorienting perceptions that makes your mind work different, where you don't have a filter ready.
All right. Well, we have to filter this down for the next conversation.
Yes.
Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome, Beth.
Talk to you in 2 weeks.
Sure.
Political analyst Neil Milner is our contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, comedy hypnosis and hypnotic comedy on Kauai. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, o mau, o kaholabe, o hawai.
In today's backyard, we're bird watching. The first native bird to sing in the morning and the last to stop singing at night. And this morning, we're looking for its name. That name in Hawaiian is based on the sound it makes, which is described in one guidebook as, quote, a pleasant and rather loud warble. There are three species in Hawaii. Each one is exclusive to its island, one on Kauai, one on Hawaii Island, and one on Oahu. There's no record of them having been found on Maui or Molokai, and nobody knows why. The birds play a significant role in Hawaiian culture. Canoe builders say they help them select the best koa trees for carving. If the birds are pecking at a fallen tree, that usually meant the tree was filled with insects and was therefore full of holes and a poor candidate for making a canoe. If the birds didn't peck at it, well, then the tree was a sturdy specimen. This morning, we're looking for the name of this helpful native bird. We'll be back with it in half an hour, but in the meantime, if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get the right answer gets the T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Vice Admiral Phil Cullum from the United States Navy. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Most of us who watch and enjoy comedy improv performances would never dream of getting on stage and trying to do what the performers are doing, but would we, under hypnosis, transform into another Robin Williams? There's only one way to find out. Ron Soderstrom has been performing for years as both a comedy artist and a hypnotist, and he's hoping to take audience members into that uninhibited zone that only the best performers can reach. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm fascinated by the intersection of these two professions.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, actually, I was surprised myself, but they just fit together so absolutely well.
Well, do you think that's accurate, that a lot of people who watch improv, they want you to be uninhibited, but they don't want to be?
You know what? In some cases, but the shows that I was participating in, we had plenty of times where we brought the audience up into it, and they obviously were enjoying themselves during that time.
So what do you do when you bring the audience on stage with you?
For the improv or for the stage hypnosis?
Either one.
Either one, okay. For the improv, it was just basically having them take part of the skits, being able to, we'd have a guessing game sorts of things. Now, with the stage hypnosis, it takes a lot of the stress and the pressures off of that audience member to be able to come up.
Yeah.
Put them into a relaxed state to where they lose their inhibitions, actually their worries, their concerns, and they just get to enjoy themselves, be able to immerse themselves in the story that's being played out.
What are the things that you do that get them to that state?
Now, that goes to my definition of what hypnosis is. You know, there's lots going out there, but for my personal one, the one that I enjoy, is that to be in hypnosis, to be in trance, you just have to be in an intense state of focus where you eliminate all the distractions around you. Now, by helping to guide people into that state to where they're just immersed in the story, whatever happens to be playing out at that time, they don't care about what other people are thinking about them. They get to just enjoy themselves, be able to have fun.
That's, you know, maybe a more scientific definition of hypnosis involves an actual altered state, doesn't it?
You know what? To be honest with you, Chris, we're actually in that state many times throughout the day. Whenever we get ourselves, when we find ourselves lost in a daydream and we just don't notice the things around us, even being lost up in Facebook, when you see people just scrolling down through the screen and you're talking to them right next to them, right behind them, and they don't seem to notice you, they've actually put themselves into a state of trance to where they're just so focused on that that they just don't realize.
So hypnosis, as defined by you, is intense concentration.
Correct.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure out how that gets induced by another, you know, by a third party.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So what I do during that time, Chris, is just have them concentrate, have them focus on, let's say, an object, just be able to have them concentrate on that object, just listen to whatever happens to be, whatever music, whatever sounds go on to create a sound of ambiance. The way that I love to actually describe it is, let's say you're laying out on the beach. It's a beautiful, beautiful day. You've got the sun beating down on you. It's just perfect. Now, you're so comfortable out there, you find yourself starting to drift off, kind of get into a bit of a nap.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear the voices, you hear the noises around you. But it really doesn't matter. You're just so comfortable. You're just enjoying yourself in that state. It's actually real similar to what people feel like when they're in the state of hypnosis. They're just in a wonderful, comfortable place.
Ron, have you ever been hypnotized?
Oh, many times. Many times. I love it. To be honest with you, I went through some stressful times in my life. And I was looking for different resources, different modalities to be able to assist myself, to be able to get into a higher state of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I found. I found hypnosis, and I just keep on moving forward ever since.
So you found somebody to hypnotize you, a professional hypnotist?
Yes, I did, yes.
And that really brought you to some different places?
Immensely, yeah.
Do people to whom you have done this, people on your shows, what do they tell you about the experience?
Oh, that they've had a wonderful time. If a person is willing, now that's the big caveat to it. You know, you'll see stage hypnosis shows where some people, they'll let them back down into the audience during the time. If someone is willing to go along with the process and they want to enjoy themselves, then they're going to have themselves an absolutely fantastic time, no mm-hmm. doubt about it.
Because I had this picture in my mind, Ron, of this guy, you know, who might even resemble me, sort of with his arms folded, saying, "Well, you're not going to hypnotize me." If you have that determination, it's not going to happen, right?
Right. And if that's what they expect out of time, if they want to be confrontational out of it, then they don't want to have any fun at that moment. And the whole idea about a stage hypnosis show is giving people an opportunity to have as much fun as they want to.
Sure. And you, once they're in this more relaxed state in that zone, you then have them do, you can get them to sort of do an improv exercise, a comedy exercise?
Exactly. The same type of of skits that you'll see, let's say, in an improv comedy show, are usually related straight over into a stage hypnosis show. Now, rather than myself acting everything out, I get to help to guide the participants so that they get to have all the fun.
Well, Ron, when I talk to comedy improv artists, they always talk about how necessary it is to be very attentive to the other people on stage, to the cues they're giving you, you know, the whole thing of yes and. But that's not an interior state. That's very open to everybody else state. Are those things compatible?
Oh, most definitely. Now, that goes back to the definition that I gave you at the beginning, was being in an intense state of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're focused in on what the story is with the stage show. They're focused in on what's going on up on the stage, what the story is going on up there.
So that can be an exterior focus, Ron.
Oh, definitely, most definitely. Also, when you describe it as being in the zone, let's say an athlete, when they're out there and they want to be at their absolute best, they definitely have to be able to eliminate the distractions. Let's say a basketball player, they're going for a free throw. They've got all that crowd right in behind the basket. They're doing everything they can to distract that guy. But he's able to focus himself so intently just on what he is doing, making that shot, that he's able to eliminate all that distraction. So,
well, Ron, we'll look forward to your show. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. I greatly appreciate it.
Ron Soderstrom will perform his comedy hypnosis show, Welcome to Paradise, Saturday, February 27th at Lihue Parish Hall in Lihue, Kauai.
What is the 2016 campaign really?
Ultimately, it is a job interview for a very important job that's not only going to affect the citizens of the United States, but also actually the world.
Novelist Suki Kim reports from Marco Rubio's world and has some thoughts on the strangest process for filling the world's most important job. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
On the street where you live, Nielsen Research tells us that it's likely that 1 in 8 of your neighbors listens to HPR every week. Some of them have gone beyond merely listening and, with their financial support, have made our service available to the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors, Brian and Nan Kitagawa of Kamuela, Nida Kahoj of Haiku, and Elson Gushikin of Mililani. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours or by visiting hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. The controversial promotion of Ryan Borges to assistant police chief is taking another turn. HPD has announced it will launch an internal affairs investigation to see whether he violated internal standards when he solicited outside support. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair picks up the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so first let's remind everyone why his promotion was so controversial in the first place.
Right. So Borges was convicted more than 20 years ago of terroristic threatening in a domestic violence case, domestic abuse case, and it involved a handgun. And since that time, he had 2 temporary restraining orders placed against him involving harassments and threats. But nonetheless, Chief Louis K. Aloha has said he has done better in life, and he deserves to be major. So that's the background. This latest development is, well, this is unexpected. So for some reason, HPD posted on its Facebook page letters of support for Major Borges. They come from people that we know, like Duke Iona, the former lieutenant governor, and Ernie Martin, the city council chair. But that may have been in violation because you cannot, as an officer with HPD, solicit support for a promotion. That is a violation of department protocol. So that's what Internal Affairs is looking into.
And they're really trying to assess whether he actually solicited these letters or these were people who just felt called to write them.
Well, that's a good question. And then one of the things that a police department chief has said is that the letters appear to actually have been written after the promotion was already a done deal. But there's another development as well. Borges has a letter of his own. And by the way, the letter from Borges, as well as the letters from Duke Iona and Ernie Martin and others, they're on our website. You can go and take a look at them. They're in Nick Gruby's article. There's a letter from Borges in which he says that he has been under spiritual attack. He has been victimized by, and he names him specifically, Senator Willis Sparrow, who, as we know, is a strong advocate for police reform. Borges even uses words like the enemy. The enemy is out to get me, calls himself a sinner who has repented. Well, as Sparrow is saying, he still wants to have Borges' nomination withdrawn, primarily because of his history of domestic violence. But he certainly wasn't pleased with his latest development, very much attacking Willis Sparrow by name.
Is there any timeline to this investigation, a sense that this is going to be immediately done as opposed to just an announcement, and then we don't know anything until some point in the future?
Well, the promotion takes effect February 28th, so time would seem to be of the essence. And in another development, Mayor Caldwell met with Chief Kealoha to discuss the promotion. Afterwards, a spokesman for the mayor said, there's no place for domestic violence in our community or at HPD. So more pressure to get to the bottom of this.
Well, the end of the month is not that far away.
No,
so
not.
We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks. Thanks. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily for a reality check.
Tonight at 5, we'll be bringing you Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, you're on a voyage to Papahanaumokuakea.
Hey, you're pretty good.
Not bad, huh?
Yes, otherwise known as the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, and we've talked to the crew of the Okeanos a couple of times, but mm-hmm. every time they go up on a trip, they go looking at something different. A couple of months ago, about 6 months ago, they were looking at new species of coral and fairly deep sea, creatures. And this time I think they're going in to explore some seamounts. And I guess these are underwater volcanic activity.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll join them and talk a little bit about what they plan to discover. And we'll have them in the studio. And, it's a cool thing because they can share about what they go out there and discover, and they actually webcam live a lot of their viewings as they go and explore the deep sea. So it's a kind of a fun thing, just like going into outer space, but they're going into deep sea.
Well, just like outer space, well, unlike outer space, it's teeming with life, and like outer space, there's lots to discover, right?
Well, that's true. I think we're on the verge of discovering life, elsewhere mm-hmm. off the planet. But if you look at some of the creatures and the conditions that they live in here on Earth, they could very well be pretty alien. So it's always cool to watch some of the things that they discover as they scan the bottom of the ocean floor.
Well, when we do make contact, I'm counting on you to have them on your show, Bert.
Most definitely. terrestrial or extraterrestrial.
Yeah, we're not proud, right?
No, not at all.
Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure
we'll
thing.
Look forward to that. That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Often told about the two certainties of life, and while no one can change the end of the road for any of us, how much tax you pay along in the future could be changing. Today, the Senate Ways and Means Committee will take up a bill to reinstate higher individual tax rates. It's one of several hikes that could be approved this session, and all are raising eyebrows at the Hawaii Tax Foundation. Foundation President Tom Yamachika is back in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Beth Ann.
Last year, we talked about what might happen with the 9, 10, and 11% tax tax rates for individuals. It sunsetted at the end of last year, and now it's back. Chances of seeing this more permanently?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the Senate Ways and Means Committee had a hearing on it, and you know, there's also a House companion, but that hasn't been heard yet. But where it is at the moment is that the chair intends to pass something out that is, you know, so-called revenue neutral, but with the higher tax rates. What she wants to do is to bring the higher tax rates back in and lop off the lower brackets and result in a revenue neutral bill. And what that means to me is it's a Robin Hood bill. So you take from the rich, give to the poor. That seems to be the point of it.
Which seems more politically driven than financially.
That's correct. I mean, if it's revenue neutral, it wouldn't be financially driven.
At this point, we have been looking at the history of this, and we've talked about this a couple of times, but just to kind of catch everybody up with that too, this didn't exist until we kind of hit recessionary times, and then we saw it happen over the veto of Governor Lingle in 2009.
Right. Basically, the genesis behind the 9, 10, and 11% tax rates was that we were in a recession. We'd just been hit with the 2007-2008 economic shocks. State government was in a tailspin, and the legislature thought they needed to do something. So they basically said, okay, folks, here's what we're going to do. We're going to raise tax rates, but on a temporary basis. So they said we'll enact them in 2009. They'll expire at the end of 2015. So 5 years of pain, and that'll be it. At least that's what they said at the time. Last year, of course, in last session, there was a movement afoot to keep the rates there, since people were used to them already. We, among others, kind of stood up and said, well, wait a minute. I mean, you promised that these would be temporary. Come on, And I think, cooler heads prevailed. The bills to keep the rate, the higher rates died. And we, as of right now, have a top tax rate of 8.5%.
For some people who say, okay, this brings up the issue of, is temporary really temporary? And what about the issue of, fair share? Shouldn't people who are making a whole lot more be paying a whole lot more? How do you answer them?
Well, those are policy decisions that need to be made. Certainly for a state like ours that depends a lot on the GET, the GET is known to be a regressive tax, which means it bites harder on those who are less able to afford it, because as it is a flat percentage on what you buy, it doesn't discriminate based on whether you have ability to pay or not. Whereas income tax, at least they take a look at the ability to pay as measured by the amount of income you get, less your deductible expenses, and it says, okay, well, if you make more, you should pay more. And that's what's called a progressive tax, as opposed to the GET, which is a regressive tax. So, like the Democratic Party of Hawaii, among others, has kind of made it fairly clear that progressivity is an important piece of the tax system. The income tax does provide progressivity, and the question, for policymakers is, well, how high do you go?
And if you're talking about something that is revenue neutral, does it in fact meet that criteria?
Oh, yes. I mean, it does redistribution, so it'll further the goals of progressivity.
You bring up the GET. There are two bills in two different areas, one in education with the HSTA omnibus bill, the other in long-term care. The long-term care would add 0.5% to the surcharge, and the HSTA would add a percentage, but 1%. But that also brings up the whole idea of using the GET for fundraising purposes. And you say that's part of the problem.
Well, that's right. Ever since the door was opened with the rail surcharge, lawmakers have been looking at more creative ways to raise money. And let me just kind of start with the teacher's omnibus bill, because that's probably the bigger of the two. It's projected to raise over $750 million a year, and they want it to go to education. And they do this by raising the base rate of the GET from 4% to 5%, which is a 25% increase. The issue with that is the GET, at least the way we've set it up in our state, it is extremely broad. It hits everything in the economy, so it'll have a very, very tremendous ripple effect.
And making the point that you made earlier, that you're already talking about a tax that people regard as being regressive.
That's right, and it would exacerbate that that particular effect.
Even for a good reason.
Well, that's for the lawmakers to decide.
Long-term care is using the same principle.
Right. For long-term care, what they want to do is they want to tack on a 0.5% surcharge to the GET, similar to what they did for rail, but on all islands, and use that to come up with a defined benefit plan. What that's essentially what it is. Now the benefit that would be paid by the defined benefit plan is $7 a day for a year for those who need long-term care. And the issue is, at least in our mind, is that the state really hasn't done too well with defined benefit plans in the past. We've got the ERS right now. As of June 30th of 2013, it was underfunded by some $8 billion. With a B. And then, of course, there's the health care plan, the EUTF, which is underfunded by $18 billion as of 2013. So, and with some 2013 legislation, they're starting to pay it down, but it's still a big number.
Your point with both of the bills, the HSTA omnibus bill and the long-term care bill, is that we're going to have to separate some of the emotion toward it with what you say might be the real dollars and cents of how well the state has been able to perform with similar types of bills. And we just talked about the pensions and retirement plans.
Right. So there's one aspect of, can the state efficiently use the money that it has? Okay. Two is you got to think about what happens if you squeeze people too hard. You know, they don't necessarily have to vote at the ballot box. They can vote with their feet. So, and you've seen over the past several years, there's been a net out migration from Hawaii. People are moving elsewhere. Some people are fed up with the high taxes, and they're out of here.
But you're also talking about people who can't necessarily move. If you're really talking about poor people who may truly be stuck here and not see any other option, not have any other place to go, they'd still be stuck paying a higher GET regardless.
Or they'd be out in the streets, and you see a lot of those around.
Before you go, I want to ask you about one more tax in there. Part of the governor's package was the vehicle tax rate hike.
Yes. So what happened there was there was a section of the fuel tax that sunset at the end of last year, just like for the income tax. And so a lot of the rates dropped back down. Like, for example, the tax on gasoline, the state component, dropped from 17 to 16 cents. And so the Department of Transportation is coming in with a bill to reinstate that. And they go, oh, by the way, since we're here, can we get a little bit more, to keep our highway system afloat? But then you got to wonder about that, because the Department of Transportation gets all these these grants from the federal government, and they can't spend the money. And that was evident from hearings that happened this past summer.
So as you talk about that money not being spent while the Department of Transportation is asking for more, what is the key part in there that you think that people aren't really understanding in linking the fact that, you know, we need to have a good transportation system, we need to be able to have roads that are viable, and everyone's always talking about how poor they are.
Yeah, well, I think the question you have to really drill down and get to the meat of is, you know, why can't these agencies spend the money that they're given? What are the bottlenecks? Is it a problem with procurement? Is it a problem with contract review? Is it a problem with, you know, federal requirements? You know, where's the problem, and how do we solve it?
And your point is, it may not be a problem with new money.
Right. I mean, people think a lot of problems can go away if you just throw money at them, but that isn't always the case.
Tom, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Tom Yamachika is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jessica Leboeuf from Cirque du Soleil, Kidam. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a native bird that stays close to home. There are three species in the islands, each of them exclusive to its home island, one on Kauai, one on Hawaii Island, one on Oahu. Canoe builders in ancient times used them as a kind of bellwether. They clustered around a fallen koa tree. That meant it was full of delicious bugs, delicious to them, but it was also full of holes. That made the tree a useful foraging site for the birds, but of little use to canoe builders. If they left a fallen tree alone, it was still sturdy enough to allow builders to carve a good canoe. Hawaiians used to say, "Ua elepaio I kava'a." The canoe is marked out by the elepaio. And elepaio is the name we went looking for today. Nobody got that, surprisingly, but at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaiian culture lives on in the language, so the creation of a theater event, an extended drama in untranslated Hawaiian, is a welcome sign that both language and culture are thriving. La'ie I Kava'i, written and directed by Tammy Hailiopua Baker, brings a classic story to the stage. It's coming to Kauai, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning, Tammy.
Aloha.
What got you started on this idea?
So about 20 years ago, as a senior thesis, while I was doing my undergraduate at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, I wanted to direct a play in Hawaiian.
Uh-huh.
And I went and looked through all the archives here at the University of Hawaii and the different libraries, and actually went down to Bishop Museum and wasn't able to get my hands on a script. So by default, I ended up becoming a playwright as well.
That's the best way to do it. That's the best way to do it, isn't it, Tammy?
Yeah.
Necessity, forced. Go ahead.
Yeah. So in 1995, we did a production entitled Kalui Ko'olau.
Uh-huh.
And this was a story for a man from Kauai, Ko'olau. Many, many people have heard this story. He was famed as Ko'olau, the leper, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And so the task there was to retell history from our Hawaiian perspective, and that was the first of a number of Hawaiian language plays that we were able to produce Ria Kahala Hana Kiaka, which was a grassroots group of Hawaiian language speakers and learners who wanted to do entertainment in our language.
So,
and,
go
yeah.
ahead. I'm sorry, Tammy, go on.
No, so basically over the past 20 years, we've been doing productions connected to the university, and through the work that I was doing at Kauai Hualani Center for Hawaiian Language when I was an instructor there. And 3 years ago, a position opened up in the Department of Theater and Dance to create a Hawaiian theater program. And so this Hawaiian theater program is really the institutionalization of these different Hawaiian performing arts that, you know, our kupuna have been doing for centuries.
Sure.
And we're now able to create a program where individuals can come to the university and they can learn these skills and they can be a part of Hawaiian medium production.
What was it about this particular story?
So La'i Kawai, I believe that this story selected itself and was kind of came forward to a number of us that this was a story to be told at this time. This particular story comes back like every so many years throughout history. We see it being reprinted in the old newspapers. We see publications and as novels,
uh-huh.
as pieces of literature, and then music being written for this particular story. There's so many different embedded lessons in this particular story, and I think that this, you know, great loved daughter of Hawaii, La'ie Kawai, really holds a significant place in our history. And her story and the challenges, the journeys that she goes on in her story is something that resonates with us today.
What kind of lessons? You speak of the lessons of the story. What are some
yeah.
of those?
So primarily there's lessons in familial relationships
uh-huh.
And our familial obligations. In addition to that, there's also lessons in our relationship to the environment and the world around us and how we're accountable for the impact that we make on these various resources in nature.
Well, just to sketch an outline of the story, would you kind of sketch an outline of the story for me, Tammy?
Okay, sure. So this comes from a large body of work,
mm-hmm.
This literature, actually. The story is about the same La'ie twins, La'ie Kawai and La'ie Lohelohe.
Uh-huh.
For the sake of staging a production that is manageable in a 2.5-hour time frame, we decided to follow just one of the twins and her journey. So in this story, we'll have La'ie Kawai, the birth of her and the twins, and then their separation at birth.
Mm-hmm.
They're taken into hiding and raised separately. La'ie Kawai, as she's taken up to Paliuli on the Big Island in Hawaii and raised by a grandmother, Waka. So we see that unfolding. And then we see the many suitors that come to wed her, come to woo her. And one of the major stories, and I think this is going to resonate really nicely on Kauai, is the group that comes over from Kauai. It's Aiwohi Kupua High Chief and all of his Maile sisters. So each different Maile has a fragrance that she brings with her, and she tries to release this fragrance
mm-hmm.
Of particular Maile. So we have Maile Kaluhea, Maile Haiwale, Maile Pakaha, and Maile Lauli'i. So each Maile makes an attempt to woo La'ie Kawai for their brother. They are not successful.
Mm-hmm.
And Aiwohi Kupua actually abandons them with the baby sister, Kahala Omapuana, abandons all his sisters and returns to Kauai, disappointed that they're not able to get his desire for him. What ends up happening in the story is that these sisters befriend La'ie Kawai, and we see a new family bond that is created, and this sisterhood. And the rest of the story really is about how these sisters are being there for one another and holding each other up at times of despair. And so it's a story about sisterhood.
It sounds as if it can also, Tammy, be enjoyed whether or not you understand the Hawaiian language. I would
absolutely
think that you can pretty
absolutely
much get a good idea of what's going on stage. Good luck with this next production, and thanks very much for talking
thank
with
you
us.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Tammy Haileopua Baker is an assistant professor at UH Manoa and is the author and director of Laie Kauai, which will be performed Friday, February 26th at the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center.
This week on Bridging the Gap, we'll continue to explore the roots of soul, jumping across the world from Semba to Samba, from Chess to Motown. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. for Bridging the Gap here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Bethann, I was glad to hear Neil Milner remind us that no one reporting on things like the issues in a presidential election is entirely free from implicit bias, because we're going to be seeing a lot of conclusions of social scientists and pollsters who want you to believe that what they say is entirely authoritative, and it never can be entirely, can it?
Oh, that's the price of being human, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But at least Neil is willing to admit it, which I thought was refreshing.
Well, I mean, he's been reading a lot of this, and there are lots of other social scientists and researchers who have been looking into this, and not just in the ways that, you know, we talk about it, certainly looking at what Justin Levinson has been doing with his racial studies. Mm-hmm. But it's more than that. It's the fact that we all have to, if we're willing to, you know, look in the mirror and say, what else might be operative here? But a lot of us don't.
We certainly
talked
don't
about before. We just look for agreement.
That's right.
That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday morning. But we're going to be back with you tomorrow talking to Mark Bittman, former New York Times food columnist, about the future of food.
And if you'd like to reach us through our talkback line, it's 808-792-8217. Reach us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
If you miss any part of the show or you want to find other good things, all you have to do is look at the HPR2 archive. You can find all that information on hpr2.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning when we're back for more of The Conversation. See you then.